is a story all about how my life got flipped, turned upside down. And I'd like to take a minute, just sit right there. I'll tell you how I became the prince of a town called Bel-Air. In West Philadelphia, born and raised, on the playground is where I spent most of my days. Chilling out, maxing, relaxing, all cool and all, shooting some b-ball outside of the school. When a couple of guys who were up to no good started making trouble in my neighborhood. I got in one little fight and my mom got scared and said, "You're moving with your auntie and uncle in Bel-Air." I whistled for a cab and when it came near, the license plate said, "Freshen it a dice in the mirror." If anything, I can say that this cab was rare, but I thought, nah, forget it, yo, home's the Bel-Air. I pulled up to the house about 7 or 8 and I yelled to the cabbie, "Yo, home, smell you later." Looked at my kingdom, I was finally there to sit on my throne as the Prince of Bel-Air.
All right. How many today remember the Fresh Prince? Anybody remember the Fresh Prince? How many people were born in the 90s? Come on, raise your hand if you're born in the 90s, okay? All these 90s kids, how many? I'm sure you had a lot of days full of what? Rugrats? God help us, Barney. How many remember that purple demon? Yeah, I love you. You love me. Let's hang Barney from a tree or something like that, right? I know it. Barney, all you parents of kids of the 90s, you know what I'm talking about. God, it was really a hard time. How many were in high school during the 90s? Anybody have high school in the 90s? Yeah, a lot of flannels and Doc Martens were there, right? Couldn't get those Doc Martens soles any thicker or bigger. The bigger, the better. Those flannel shirts, even though it was 110 degrees outside, you're wearing flannels. How about, let's remember the last few years of the 90s. How many remember what happened the last few years of the 90s? Everything was, how many remember Y2K? Anybody remember Y2K? Raise your hands if you remember Y2K. How many never heard of Y2K? Raise your hand, be honest. I never heard of Y2K. God will help us. Anyway, all right. Y2K, remember this, the world was going to crash. We spent the last 3 years worrying about the year 2000. And Newsweek, Time Magazine, everybody was talking about it. When soon as 1999 ends, that first second, the clocks are going to explode in our computers, right? Because they were not programmed for the year 2000. And so they're going to go back to zero, and they're going to end up going back to zero, and everything's going to stop. All of our transportation is going to shut down. All of our electric is going to shut down. All of our gas is going to shut down. All the food, transportation, everything's going to be, we're going to be out of sync. And you should be ready because it may be a long time for things to be up and running. So they were selling Y2K survival kits. Remember those? And so you could buy a Y2K survival kit. People stocking up on non-perishable foods and waters. And how many want to be honest? Say, yeah, I was one of the crazy ones who bought some Y2K survival stuff. Anybody want to raise your hand and admit that? How many say, I did buy some extra spam? Anybody here? Okay, all right. Some water and spam and whatever. You know, you had a few things in there. Of course, we partied like it was 1999. And when the year 2000 came, nothing happened. It was kind of really wah, 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 wah. You know, it's like all this 3 years of buildup and the clock said 2000. No problems. How about that? How many remember AOL? America Online. Now, some of you think you just push a button and the internet's there and you can do anything you want. But there was a time when the internet was just limited. First of all, you had to go down to Walmart or somewhere like that, and they had these bins full of discs that you could get for free for America Online. And you would put that CD into your CD holder of your computer, put it in, and it would download, and all of a sudden you hear this sound. And then you hear it dial out. And then you like cross your fingers. No busy signal. Yes, it connected. And then it would pull up the screen and you had about a dozen choices of things you could do on the internet. And you know, these are the things you could do on the internet. And you know, when you would try to download maybe an article to read, you push, I want to download this, and this is how it would download. One page, all right, right there. It took forever to download that page down. And man, we were really living it up with the internet, right? Nowadays, we wouldn't know how to act if that's the way it was. That's the way the internet was invented. That's the way it came along, and it was really that way. How many remember pagers? Anybody remember pagers? How many had a pager in the 90s? Come on now. Yeah, I had a pager on the 90s. I had it on my belt right here. And for those who know what a pager is, if someone trusted you enough to give you their pager number, you would call that pager number, and it would leave, you pushed a certain button, and it would leave your number and send it to that pager. And if you had a pager, all of a sudden it would start vibrating, or if you had it on beep, it would beep. Beep, 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 or it'd be vibrating. You're like, wait, be quiet. You pull out your pager. I need a phone. And you had to go borrow somebody's phone and call that number on your pager. So if someone wanted to get a hold of you, they would call your pager, leave their number, and then you would borrow somebody else's phone or pull over and use a payphone and call them. So you just couldn't get a hold of people. That was fast, you know. And we had those pagers, and you wear it like a boss, you know. It was like, a pager, it must be important. You know, you felt really important wearing that pager. Then we finally started all getting cell phones. Remember, cell phones started coming out. Let's look at some of the styles of cell phones. How many remember those brick phones out in the late 80s and the early 90s, those big old bricks for a phone? And then those Nokias, and Nokia 1, Nokia 2, Nokia 3, Nokia. No service, what they should call it. Anyway, Nokia. And all these Nokias coming out and big phones. And, you know, and eventually we ended up with the flip phone. You know, I mean, how many remember when the flip phones came out? Yeah, flip phones are great. How many still have a flip phone? Raise your hand. Tell me. All right. You're like, Pastor, why break it? I learned how to do it in the 90s. I'm keeping it today. The cell phones were there. How about some of our favorite shows of the 90s? Come on now. How many kids like Full House, man? Anybody like Full House? How many got up on Saturdays and watched Saved by the Bell? Anybody like Saved by the Bell? All right, you preteens. All right, I see you there. Some of you are like, no, I was in high school. Anyway, high school. How about Friends? Anybody like Friends? Yeah. These theme songs can be stuck in your mind. I'll be what? I mean, culture, pop modern culture in our minds. How about, you know, It's All Right, I'm Saved by the what? Bell, yeah. All these theme songs come in your mind. We know them like nothing. You know, we're right there stuck in our mind. How about one of the biggest hipsters to ever come along? His name was what? Anybody remember this guy? What was his name? Steve Urkel, yeah. The original hipster. Now, back then, he was trying to portray a nerd, but nowadays people paying good money to dress like that. People buying those oversized glasses and dressing like that. He was the original hipster. Steve Urkel was not even supposed to be a part of the show Family Matters, which actually wrote into the beginning for 2 episodes. And he starred in the first 2 episodes of that show, and he took over the show so much. Of course, the show centered around him, and he became the main star of the show. And my favorite show of television show of the 90s, especially early 90s, was The Fresh Prince. Come on, how many like The Fresh Prince, man? The Fresh Prince, he was fresh, right? It was Will. As a matter of fact, I see this picture, and it reminds me of a few guys that are here today. Come on, Johnny, stand up right here. Johnny, our drummer this morning. There you go. But even better, our sound man, Mr. Terry Barry. Stand up, Terry. Look at that back there. He got his overalls, got his Will Smith outfit. There you go. This guy's looking like Fresh Prince this morning. I love Fresh Prince because, man, he was funny. And, of course, I liked his music with him and DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. And then when he got his own show, it was a funny show about a young man. And, you know, this is a pretty cool story about Fresh Prince because he was, of course, a major pop star back then. And I say pop star, he was a rap star. They had a couple of big hits, made a lot of big money early on. And of course, like any young man, he's spending it all on big things. And he was a big roller, big time baller, as we say today. He was rolling around in nice cars and threads and houses and all that stuff. And he said, I forgot to pay my taxes, though. He's like, you know, no one told me. I was like 20 years old and 21 years old. And I made all this money, but the IRS wants theirs. And I didn't pay it, so they came to collect. He goes, thank God I had the enough money to pay them, but they emptied out my bank account, and they took everything I had. They took my house, my cars, my jewelry, everything to pay off all the IRS that I owed them. He goes, so here I was, a major pop star, a major star back then. He goes, and what happened was I didn't have anything. I was taking city transportation. He goes, I had to get on the bus sometimes to take the bus somewhere because I was broke. He goes, I didn't want to tell anybody I was broke. I was too embarrassed to tell my friends I was broke. So I would get on the city bus, right? The city bus. And people are like, Fresh Prince? Will? You know, what are you doing on here? Oh, man, I'm just trying to hang out with people doing the road, you know. He's like making up stories and all that stuff. And he stayed at home depressed one day. And his girlfriend at the time said, listen, you can't stick around here. Get up and go find some work. Do something. He's like, I don't know what to do. You know what I'm going to do? All these people think I can't go out rolling in my new Benz or anything. I can't go out there and show off. He goes, I got to go do my life. Like riding city transportation. She goes, well, go hang out down to Arsenio Hall. That's what she said. Go down, hang out at Arsenio Hall show and maybe something good will happen. Just go hang out and be where people are at. Get out of the house. Do something. So he said, all right. So he went down. And he goes, I went down. This is a true story. So I went down to Arsenio Hall show, even though I wasn't booked to be on there, and just kind of hanging out, talking to Arsenio before the show and kind of hanging out backstage. And this producer walked up to him and said, hey, I want to introduce you to this writer. He's got a new show for a script, and he thinks you'd be perfect for it. And he handed him the script for the show, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He goes, man, you need to play this part. It's perfect for you. And he's like, I'd love for you to try out. He goes, oh, yeah, sure. Are you busy? He goes, like, well, I'm busy, but I think I can make it happen. And so he's like, man, I needed the job. And so he took it, and he goes, well, matter of fact, he goes, I'm going over to Quincy Jones's house, so I want you to go to Quincy's with me right after we leave Arsenio Hall. He goes, and we're going to talk to Quincy about this show. And so he went to the famous producer Quincy Jones's house afterwards, and Quincy Jones just happened to be having a big party and had all the NBC executives there at this party, and they're there, and he's like, hey, this guy comes and says, this is Quincy, this is Fresh Prince. Oh, yeah, I know, Will, come on in, I like your work, blah, blah, blah. He goes, hey, I want him to star in this show we've been talking about, and I want you to produce it. So Quincy was going to produce this show, and Will, I want you to star in it. So he goes, hey, we got all the embassy executives here. He goes, we'll clear out all the furniture. You go back and take this script and memorize this part right here and come back out. We'll do a tryout right here in front of all the embassy executives. And Will Smith was like, man, I never even had one acting class, never even tried it. They hand me a script and tell me to try out in front of Quincy Jones. And all these NBC executives are like, hey, man, I need some time to study this and practice. And Quincy was like, Will, if we try to rebook these guys, we may never get all these guys back together again. He goes, so this is your shot. Do you want to take it, or are you going to walk out the door and let it go by? He says, oh, I guess you put it that way, Quincy. I'll try it. So he went back to his room, took about 10 minutes to come out, and he auditioned for Fresh Prince right there in Quincy Jones' living room in front of NBC execs. They liked it. You want to do it? Yeah, let's do it. He goes, Will, you got a lawyer? And Will's like, I can't afford a lawyer, you know? I just lost my lawyer, and the IRS come and take all my money. He goes, well, you're a lawyer. One of his buddies was there. He was a lawyer. You're a lawyer. Write him up a contract. NBC guys, you write up a contract. Let's get it signed tonight. They wrote it up right there. Everybody there, and they signed the contract, and that's how the Fresh Prince was born. It had an amazing story. I mean, just stepped out right there. This all that happened that night. And, you know, Will's life was kind of that way, but also the show was that way. The Fresh Prince was about adversity, overcoming adversity. Will had been growing up in Philadelphia, had gotten in trouble, a lot of gang violence where he was at, so his mom worried about him. His dad was not there in his life, so his mom ships him off to Bel Air to live with his Uncle Phil, his Aunt Viv, who was a lawyer living in Bel Air. And so he goes from living in the inner city and to, oh, now he's living over here in Bel Air, Beverly Hills, in a small mansion. He's got a butler, Jeffrey. He's got his cousin, Carlton, his other cousins, you know. And he's living there, and he's had to overcome all this adversity. Does he really belong in a family? How does he transfer out to here? Where does he fit in life? Why did his dad never show up? Was his dad never involved in his life? He had all this adversity. Why did his mom make him go live there and not keep him there with him? I mean, all these things, all this adversity. The show, even though it was a lot of humor, it was a lot about overcoming adversity. It's a classic story, one of the classic stories of the 90s. And today I want to talk to you about another classic story, the original Fresh Prince. Let's talk about the original Fresh Prince, the Fresh Prince of Egypt, okay? The Fresh Prince of Egypt. Some of you are thinking, how is he going to pull this in? Well, now you know. The Fresh Prince of Egypt. Moses' life gives us some insight on how to fall and how to face uncertainty in our life. You know, all of us are going to face uncertainties in our life. All of us are going to face adversity and uncertainty, the unknown. How do we face it? And Moses' life with him and his parents give us some really good insight. But look at this statement today. When you are faithful in the moment, God is faithful in the future. When we're faithful in the moment, God is faithful in the future. How many people have you heard? Well, in the moment, I lost it. In the moment, I made a stupid mistake. It was just a moment's decision. I made a bad decision. In the moment, I lost my mind. In the moment, you know, in the moment can either change you for the good or destroy some things in your life. But I want to push you to realize this, that when you are faithful to God in the moment, God will be faithful to you in the future. That God sees every moment that you're faithful, and God sees every unknown moment when you decide to be faithful, when you decide to trust the Lord, when you decide, even though I don't understand all the answers and I can't control it, I'm going to trust God. God is faithful with our future. Now look at this story in Hebrews 11, 23. Look what it says about Moses. It says, it was by faith that Moses' parents hid him for 3 months when he was born. They saw that God had given them an unusual child. I had about 4, maybe 5 of those. And they were, they were not afraid to disobey the king's command. Now, I want you to see that it was by faith. Everybody say faith. His parents, by faith, hid him. Why is that important? Because we got to understand what's going on at this time. At this time, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, had all the Hebrews that were enslaved to them. The Hebrews were working tremendous hours building for them, working for the Egyptians. And they were their slaves, just working to survive, getting just enough to eat and provide for their family, barely enough just to take care of the food and shelter for their family. And finally someone said, hey, king, Pharaoh, listen, these Hebrews, they're producing like rabbits over here, okay? We better do something, or if we were not careful, all of a sudden you're going to have more of them than you have of us. And these boys are going to be raised up, and they're going to have more kids and more kids, and eventually they're going to overcome, and they're going to overthrow you. They're going to take over, and we're going to be working for them one day. And so Pharaoh said, all right, we'll take care of this immigration problem. I've got a good idea. I think that from now on, for a while, we're going to take all the newborn baby boys and throw them in the Nile River. The crocs can eat them, or they'll drown. One of them will happen, but this is how we're going to take care of population control. Now, some of you thought the government was kind of hard. This is really bad. Really bad. Think about it. I mean, this is this idea of population control. Let's feed our baby boys to the crocs, or let's throw them out to drown in the Nile River. But this is what was going on. And can you imagine the fear? Can you imagine the fear in Pharaoh's parents as this decree came up, but it says by faith? See, some people decide to live their life in fear. Some decide to live it by faith. By faith, they reacted differently. They were not afraid to disobey what the king had set out to happen. So write this down. Number one, let go of your need to control. Let go of your need to control. We must realize that, man, we want to control a lot, don't we? We like being control freaks. I mean, every one of us at some point in our life, our children, and we did the same thing. At some point, we decide that we're going to tell our parents or a parent, you're not the boss of me. Or say, you're not my boss. And when that happens, when my child comes to an age, when they decide they think it's okay to tell me that, I can't tell you what happens. I can only tell you the spirit of Darth Vader comes inside of me. And I'm like, dear Jesus, help me not to kill this child. Because all of a sudden they tell me I'm not the boss of them. And I'm like, listen, let me just tell you something. First of all, I am the boss of you. As long as you're living in my house, I am the boss of you. And just so you know it, you're going to have people who are the boss of you for the rest of your life. If you don't want to have somebody who's the boss of you, don't get married, okay? I'm just telling you. Come on now. We got to smile. We got to laugh. We got to know we're always going to have a teacher who's over us. We're going to have a superintendent who's over us. We're going to have somebody who's a leader over us. We're going to have a boss. We're going to always have people who are telling us what to do. And so we're going to have people in control. But we don't like that, do we? We don't naturally like to give up control. But listen, you got to learn that you got to give up control. You control the things you can control, but you got to remind yourself that we can't control everything. Some things are out of our control. We can't control everything. As much as we want to, we can't control everything. Life happens, and we don't see things coming out of our control. We didn't see getting laid off. We didn't see this rejection. We didn't see this company going out of business. We didn't see this health crisis. I mean, life happens. We didn't see it. You got to deal with it. Things are out of your control. My son and I were talking this week. This is actually his last Sunday for a while. He reports to camp at Missouri State for football this next week. So he's going to be gone for a while. It's been good having you home this summer. You know, this summer he's been here with Dad, and we've been talking. And he told me this, you know, we're talking. He's like, you know, you sign up as an athlete. You sign up for 4 to 5 years to play for that school. And then the next year, some of the coaches, they can just take another job. And the coaches are free to move jobs. They get promoted or they go get fired or whatever happens. And things happen. And these coaches, they can leave and go. And then you have another coach comes in over you. And some guy you didn't know, someone who didn't recruit you, and you signed up to go and play for these coaches. The next thing you know, you can be playing for somebody totally different. And it's kind of like, you know, that's not really fair. It's not fair that they can kind of do what they want. And we got to stay committed to the university for 45 years. But life is that way. Life is not fair. There's things out of your control. There's things that happen. And this is one small example. Things out of our control, we can't control that. And the sooner we realize I can't control everything, some things I can control. I can control my attitude. I can control my work ethic. I can control my tongue. I can control my heart. I can control how hard I work. I can control a lot of things, but some things I can't control. And so what I've got to learn is I control what I can control, and what I can't control, I got to give it to God. I got to learn to surrender to God. We can control some things, but a lot of things we can't. Wisdom knows what you can and cannot control. Are you hearing me? Wisdom understands I can control this, but I can't control that. And I got to know this is out of my control. I can't stress about things that are out of my control. So think about this story. Moses' parents, now it says Moses reached the age of 3 months. They no longer can hide him. Now he's at the age where he's alert. He's crying loud. There's no way they can keep him hid. They've been keeping him hid, but he's growing. They know there's no way we can keep him hid. And so they said, you know what? We're going to put him in the Nile. We're going to obey the king, but yet we're going to disobey the king. Because they said they took a basket, something similar to this, and they made it waterproof. They tarred it and got it waterproof, and they put baby Moses in there, and then they kind of hid him up in there, and then they kind of gently put him down to the edge of the Nile. And the Bible says that they trusted to put him there. Then it says his older sister, Miriam, kind of watched the basket, and she kind of followed it along as it went along the water's edge. And it just so happened that the basket got it held up right at the place where Pharaoh's daughter was out there with her workers, her servants are out there bathing and doing their things out there at the river. And she told one of her workers, go out there and get me that basket. Bring it in and see what's in it. She pulled it in and opened it up, and baby Moses is in there crying. And it says he was crying, and her heart was moved because she saw a Hebrew child. She knew he was a Hebrew. And she says she saw this Hebrew child crying, and it moved her heart. And as she was doing that, she goes, I'm going to take this baby, and I'm going to keep it as my own. And about that time, his sister, Miriam, who'd been watching, walks up, and she goes, Princess, let me tell you this. I know a Hebrew woman who is able to nurse, and she could nurse that baby for you. She could help you watch that Hebrew child. She goes, go get that woman and tell her I will pay her. And I want you to get this. I will pay her to take care of this child and to raise him for me. Now, I want this just to blow your mind and think about what just happened. Pharaoh's wanting to kill my child. I'm trusting the Lord. I'm done all I can. It's out of my control. But God, I'm still believing you that you're going to make a way when it seems like there's no way. God, I'm trusting you that even though I don't know the outcome, but whatever the outcome, God, you're in control. They put him there. They push the basket. And all of a sudden, your daughter shows up and says, Mom, Dad, come here. You got to hear this. I was following Moses down the aisle. And it just so happened that just so happened that Pharaoh's daughter found Moses. And I told her about, she wants to keep him for herself, but she said she wanted to hire, you're not going to get this, Mom. She wants to hire you to come back and to nurse and to raise Moses as your own. How many moms will tell me today, you would love to get paid to raise your own children? Come on, Mom. Ain't nobody ever offered to pay you to raise your own child. But I'm telling you, when you trust the Lord and you stay faithful to God, things unusually happen to you that you can't explain. You can't explain why the favor of God came to you that way. You can't understand these things. But all of a sudden, she's being paid to take care of her own child. And so now, what an awesome thing to think about when you trust the Lord in a way that makes no sense. When you trust God and you don't see, I only control what I can control. At a certain time, it gets out of my control. Sometimes we get there. Sometimes the parents were there. God, I've raised them up. God, I've trained them up. God, I've prayed over them. And now I put them into your hands. God, I place them into your hands. I don't know what the outcome is going to be, but God, I'm putting my children into your hands. God, you're in control. God, I don't know the outcome of what's going to happen here, but God, I'm trusting you. I've done everything I can do to be faithful. God, we're putting our eyes upon you. We're trusting you in every area of our life. Moses' parents were faithful in the moment, and God was faithful with their future. Wow. Control what you can. Surrender the rest to God. You need to release. Look at this. You need to release to God the things we cannot control. Release to God the things you cannot control. Learn to let them go. Surrender them to the Lord. And number two, you got to learn to do this. Move on from disappointments. Move on from disappointments. We know that life is full of disappointments. And we must learn how to deal with them. We got to learn how to deal with disappointments in life. We're not good at that, are we? Let's be honest. We're not good with dealing with disappointments. If we're not careful, it can wreck us. And for some people, they can be stuck there for the rest of their life. I know people that are stuck at major disappointments, and they never were able to get beyond it. They were never able to go beyond. And for many of them, it's been decades. And they're still emotionally tied to that disappointment. They're still stuck there emotionally to the major disappointment in their life. The Bible talks about a time when Moses was, he was growing up older. And now he grew up in the palace. But of course his mom raised him. But he lived in the palace as well as a prince. He was the fresh prince. All the ladies wanted him. He was the single man. I mean, he was looking fine. Ladies, I'm telling you right now. The bachelor would have been all over this guy. Come and be the next bachelor. I mean, Moses was there, and, you know, he was growing up, but he also grew up having his Hebrew heritage given to him by his mom. Can you imagine, Mom, Moses, you're really my son. This is what God did. You're being raised as Pharaoh's son, but I want you to know your children are, your family is Hebrew, and one day God's going to use you. One day, God's got a plan for you. He's going to help you be a part of the plan of setting the Hebrews free. So Moses grows up, and he sees this. He understands it. One day, it says he's out strolling and looking over, and he sees one of the guards, Egyptian guards, abusing and beating one of the Hebrew slaves. And in a moment of rage and anger, he beats the man. He kills the man for abusing the Hebrews. And the Bible says that he took it, and he hid the man in the sand, thinking that nobody had saw him. But the next day, he was out, and he was trying to break up a fight between two Hebrew workers. And they said, what are you going to do, kill us like you did that Egyptian guard? He was shocked because he didn't realize anybody knew about it. So at that moment, he realized the word is out. It was spreading all over camp. And it got back to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh was trying to kill him, that he killed one of the Egyptian guards. And so Moses had to flee the palace. Think about this. He had to leave the palace disgraced. He had to run for his life out of the palace. He went from being the most eligible bachelor in all of Egypt, not wanting for a thing, loved by the Hebrews and loved by the Egyptians, to now he's running for his life. Talk about disappointment. Talk about a major disappointment. And he had to flee for his life. And it says he ran to the desert. And there, the Bible talks about a story when he ran. He was getting some water from a well. And while he was there, he noticed some shepherds coming along. And they were bullying these seven sisters who had brought their father's herd to be watered there. And these seven guys stepped up. And I'm sure they were being male chauvinist pigs, you know. And they were bullying these girls. And I'm sure there was a lot of inappropriate things going on. And Moses stands up and he drives them back and he pushes them back and he says, the ladies were here first and they'll go first. He stood up for them and he helped them water their cattle. And they went back, Dad, you're not going to believe what happened. This is guy, he helped take up for us. He protected us and he watered our flocks. His dad's like, dude, I got seven daughters. Get this man back here right now. This is the kind of guy I need in my family. So go get that guy. Bring him back. And he ends up marrying one of the daughters. And this guy's name was Jethro. And Jethro was a high priest. But Jethro was also a herdsman. And he had cattle. And so what this means was simply this, that he lived from tent. And they would pick their tent up and they would move from place to place, where they could feed their cattle, where they could water their cattle. And he lived in the desert, roaming around. And Moses marries his daughter, and he lives there in the desert for 40 years, traveling from tent to here, pick up your tent, go to here, pick up your tent, go to here, pick up your tent and go to here, go find water here, out of water, go find water there, or go find food here. I mean, that's how he lived his whole life of 40 years in the desert, herding great herds of cattle, learning to live on the move in the desert, getting personally discipled by the high priest Jethro, being taught about the heart of God, who God really was. Oh, by the way, how long did Moses have to lead the children of Israel in the desert? 40 years. How did they live? From tent to tent, from place to place, going from getting water here to go over here to find water here to get fed. God would feed them. I mean, it was amazing what happened. Moses had to be the spiritual leader of a million people. How do you herd a million people throughout the desert? A guy who's been doing it for 40 years. You see, what was meant for his greatest disappointment, what he didn't understand was this: before he could ever go back and be the voice of God and set his people free and take the people out of slavery into the promised land, Moses had to be trained how to handle the desert, how to handle the desert time, how to disciple, how to herd a million people. And what the enemy meant to bring disappointment and rejection in his life, God turned it around for good. And God said, rise up, Moses. It's time for you to go back. And you're going to tell Pharaoh. You're going to walk back into the palace. But no longer are you going a fugitive. No longer are you going somebody on the run. But you're going to walk with my presence. You're going to walk with my authority. And you're going to walk into that palace. You're going to look him in the eye and say, Pharaoh, it's time. God said, let my people go. Of course, we know the rest of the story. After all the plagues, he let them go. And Moses led the great people, a million people, out of Egypt into the promised land. But that would have never happened if Moses had been stuck at that disappointment. If he'd just allowed himself to be stuck at that big mistake, that big rejection, being kicked out of the palace, he would have missed his destiny. You see, you got to understand this. It says that in Hebrews 11, 27, it was by faith that Moses, when he had left the land of Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He kept right on going. See, you got to keep on going. When you have disappointment, what happens? I keep on going. I don't give up. I keep right on going. Doesn't mean there won't be tears. Doesn't mean you won't have anxiety. Doesn't mean you won't have those things you got to fight through. But he kept on going. How? He kept his eyes on the one who was invisible. So it says he kept his eyes on God. Even though he's being majorly disappointed, he kept his eyes on God. This is how I handle disappointment. See, this disappointment was going to prepare him for his destiny. It prepared him for his destiny. And what you got to realize today, that what you may be your major disappointment in your life may be the thing that God's trying to prepare you the most through. God maybe wants to use your major disappointment, your most difficult disappointment, could be the very thing that God wants to use to reshape you, to build your faith, to become one of your best things that lead you to your destiny. Look at this last statement. That dead end that you think you're facing, that dead end is just a detour on the way to your destiny. See, the dead end doesn't stop right here at the basket. It starts here at the basket. The dead end's not here. The dream's not going to die. It's God, I'm giving you control. God, I'm giving you control. I can't control it anymore. God, I'm giving it up to you. I want our section leaders to go ahead and pass out our note cards today. As they pass those out, in just a minute, I want you, as you receive those note cards, I want you to think of the major disappointment in your life, and I want you to write it down. What's a major disappointment in your life? You don't have to sign your name, don't need your name on there. Just write out what's a major disappointment in your life. Maybe it's somewhere that you just say, Pastor, this disappointment has stuck with me for years. Maybe it's recent. Maybe it's something that happened years and years ago. But I want you to write out that major disappointment. And this amendment, we're going to bring it to the Lord. I want to confess to you today that I've had some major disappointments in my life. Just like you, I've been through major disappointments in my life. The 90s was a lot of major disappointments through the 90s. In the 90s, we lost 3 children to miscarriage. Some of those were late-term pregnancies. Those were hard. Those were difficult. I went through times when I had people who, man, tried to do evil things against me, my family. Trying to do God's work, and you have people trying to destroy everything you're about. I know what it is to do a double funeral and bury 2 relatives, a brother and sister-in-law, next to each other in the same day. Man, it's some major disappointments in life. 90s of times were really hard. A lot of good times. Man, I had some major disappointments. But I can tell you that off and on, as a pastor, you're going to have that. You're going to have major disappointments. You're going to have people that you thought you could trust that, man, you can't. It's going to happen. How do I respond? And I can tell you this today, that because I've chosen to keep my eyes upon Jesus, that God has used every major disappointment in my life, God has been so faithful. And he's taken my tears, he's taken my pain, he's taken our disappointment, and he's turned around and he's shaped me to be a better pastor, better husband, a better father. He's turned things around in my life, and I wouldn't be the pastor I am today without going through those major disappointments in my life. So disappointments don't have to stay. I don't have to stay and live at the disappointments of my life. I can choose to say, God, I can only control how I respond. I can only control my attitude. I can only control that, God, I'm trusting you when I don't even know where the answer's coming from or how am I going to get out of it. But God, I know this. I'm going to stay faithful. My eyes are fixed upon you. And God always brings us out. And so today we're going to sing this song in closing. As you do, I want you, as you feel led, to come up. Some of you today need to say, today, Pastor, I'm leaving at the altar. I'm putting in the basket my disappointment. I'm tired of this disappointment keeping me chained back. I'm tired of this disappointment keeping me held back. And today, I want to let it go. Today, I'm going to let it go. Say, God, I'm giving it up to you. I'm not going to stay at this disappointment any longer. Today, I want you to invite you to stand on your feet. And as you finish writing those down, bring them up. Put them in the baskets. And let's go back and say, God, I'm giving all my life. We're going to take time to pray over these today, so I want you just to put your hands this way to this basket. This represents a lot of pain, guys. Represents a lot of disappointment. But I'm here to tell you today that our life doesn't have to be stuck right here. If we just trust the Lord, if we just give it to the Lord today, I'm telling you that He can take the thing that seems like there's no way out, and God can turn it around for good in our life when we just give it up to Him. So, Father, today we pray over this basket. Lord, I pray that people are set free from major disappointments in their life. No longer to be a held slave to something that disappointed them or disaster to happen in their life. And God, I pray today by the Spirit of the living God that you would set us free and that our eyes would be fixed upon you, the author and finisher of our faith. And I pray that faith will begin to rise again. That God, we let go of the things we can't control. We control what we can, and we give the rest to you, and we submit it into your hands, and we fix our eyes upon you today. No longer to be a victim, no longer to be stuck in the past. But God, today we declare we are free in Jesus' name. Come on, say it. I am free in Jesus' name. I am free in Jesus' name. I am free in Jesus' name. Come on, you got a hand clap. Listen, don't pick this back up when you leave here today. Put your eyes upon Jesus. Come on now, raise that attitude indicator we talked about last week, right? Raise that attitude indicator above the storm. No, I'm going up. I'm going up. My destiny's greater than any disappointment. My destiny's greater than anything in my past. I'm picking my head up. I'm fixing my eyes upon Jesus. Go today. Give someone a high five and say, I'm moving on. Come on, give them a high five. Say, I'm moving on. God bless you. We love you. Have a great week, guys.